Tonight, I would like to do something that I've not had the opportunity to do with us as a group, and sometime because I'm here less frequently these days, and that is to take a group of questions that you will ask me, maybe five, maybe six, maybe seven questions. Can you hear me? Okay, they want it back up. Okay. All right. That better? Okay. So a group of five, six, or seven questions, and then I will, as best I'm able, weave it into a single Dhamma talk. And I'm going to ask you to take a moment to think about if there is a question you would like to have answered, rather than just, you know, straight off the top of your head. Just think about it for a moment. The category of questions that are appropriate, one is dharma question, something that's about the practice in a very direct way, the Four Noble Truths, or the factors of enlightenment, or something like that, or something about difficult emotions and how the dharma speaks to something to do with difficult emotions or living our life wisely. And then something to do with receiving whatever life is giving us at the moment. If there's something like that that you're having to be with, what life is presenting to us at this moment. It could be sadness. It could be a difficult decision you have to make. Something like that. So any of those three categories of questions. So we'll just take a moment. Okay, and maybe we should use the microphone so I can hear the questions, if that's possible. So let's start with the gentleman. Oh, well, actually, right here, right to your immediate right. Yeah.
How to be with others of many kinds while aware of self?
To be with others while aware of self.
As Buddhist practitioners, I'm wondering what your thoughts are and what the thoughts of the community are on how we can help with climate change.
Okay. Right there.
How to more quickly bring yourself back when you get lost in your story or lost in something that causes sadness or you're realizing that you've gone down that path too long and you want to bring, what techniques you can use to bring yourself back more quickly? How do you catch yourself?
Okay.
I'm interested in hearing what you do.
Okay, and then the gentleman in back right there.
How to practice with effort while letting go of results.
How practice with effort and while letting loose of results. We Buddhists like that question. Have to be careful enough that I can read my own writing, which is a bit of a challenge. And let's go around this way, so we'll come around.
Hi, how can I be of service to the Buddha Dharma unfolding in the West?
Okay, thank you. Let's do one more.
If you could speak about what is really at the heart of spiritual and personal growth.
What do you mean by at the heart?
What are we really doing?
Okay. It's a very good question to ask myself. So I want to add one myself, because it's one I've had to face here in the last couple of weeks, which is, how do you make a decision when there is no good decision to be made? I did not know I was adding this till I started hearing your questions. Okay. One of the criticisms that sometimes leveled at the Buddhist practice is that it is too self-referenced. It's too about the personal and not open to the larger community. And this gets particularly leveled at Theravadan Buddhism sometimes. But in fact, in the Buddhist cultures, there is a tremendous amount of outreach and helping. It's the monastics who do a lot of the teaching of the children, for instance. And it was monastics in Burma who tried to save their vast, beautiful forest from being logged for export. And so there is a history of social activism. And at the same time, there's, as the Dalai Lama says, there's much that Buddhists can learn from the Christian tradition in terms of service. And then in the same way, there comes the question about, as a Buddhist, is it attachment to outcome if I'm in some way get involved in social activism? The clear answer in the West is no, not at all. That is, there's nothing wrong with that. And so one way that this has come up recently in the Western Theravada Buddhism is about 18 months ago, or it could have been 2.5 years ago. I lose track of time, as most of you know. I don't actually measure time in years in that way. That at a international teachers meeting that took place at Spirit Rock, all the Buddhist teachers that were there, it was a meeting of teachers from a number of different countries in Europe and the U.S. and Canada, the teachers decided to make climate change a central teaching, that this care of the planet and the non-harming in relation to the planet should be something that is taught in sanghas. And since then, there have been a number of things that have been done to speak to this end. And you can, if you Google Buddhist and or chrome it, or whatever it is, the Buddhist and climate change, you can find various ways of that. There's been a number of online forums. There's been various kinds of letters and various kinds of local activity everywhere around this issue of climate change, and I'm very glad for the opportunity to speak to it and to urge all members of this Sangha to participate in speaking to this, both in political terms, in terms of supporting the political process that makes climate change a priority. And as you know, in the United States, this is really a difficult situation because there's a very large group of people in the political process who say that human beings have little or nothing to do with climate change, and there's little or nothing we should do about it. And in most people's opinion, that science is saying otherwise, but that is the strong political opinion. So there's a need for political process. And you're not being a Buddhist when you're doing this, you're being a human being who cares. But you are acting from the precept of non-harming, because non-harming in relation to climate change applies to the climate itself and all life on the planet. The most immediately recognizable is what's happening to our oceans, and where we're destroying life so fast, and then the degree to which we're causing mass extinction of species on land. And then in turn, this will affect all sentient beings, including human beings, where we're already causing loss of life as a species. And so there's not one thing that would be particularly Buddhist to do, but rather to do whatever you can in whatever way. And this leads to a larger question of social change and just how we make a difference. One way we can make a difference is in holding the Dharma and introducing people to the Dharma, and the people in our lives, the people in our lives that we know, and then reaching out in whatever way. I was very skeptical for a long time about this one person at a time approach. How do you bring change about? Well, you bring change about one person at a time. Because I'm a systems thinker and had some degree of success in the world as a systems thinker, where I would create a blueprint and implement it on a wide basis and get a large number of people to get interested and go along with whatever I was trying to establish, whether it was getting them to buy my magazine or whatever it was. I had some success at that, and I was dynamic, so I wanted change to happen according to my timetable with it. But as I've watched human beings over these decades now, I've sort of moved over either being in that school of one person at a time, or at least including it as equally important. And this is, those of you who want to help Buddhism support the Dharma in the West, this is one way to understand it. Anything you do, whether it's having a reading group, whether it's the way you interact with someone in the store, anything where you represent the precepts, you represent the basic Buddhist values, including the Eightfold Path in terms of wise intention and so forth. Anytime we do this in an organized way or just spontaneously in the marketplace, in the world, in our society, or in specific little bits, little acts of organization that you do, you are participating in the enlisting of not people becoming Buddhist. Nobody cares about people becoming Buddhist. I don't know any Buddhist teachers that are wanting people to become Buddhist, but rather to becoming Buddhas. This is the interest, is may we all become more and more Buddha in our behavior, in our thoughts, words, and actions. And so when organizing about what to do, how to serve the Dharma, this is how I would first say, be a Buddha, not a Buddhist. And then support the processes where people get introduced to this idea that values make a difference. Because mindfulness has become so popular now, it is becoming more and more viewed as a utilitarian tool. And there is less remembrance that there are three pillars to Buddhism. One is generosity, one is sila, and one is bhavana, this becoming. And so you know that the sila, the ethical behavior, and the dana, the generosity. The bhavana is becoming what? Becoming one who can choose non-suffering over suffering. And how does one do that? One chooses the kind of suffering that leads to the end of suffering rather than the kind of suffering that leads to more suffering. So simple and yet so beautifully architected by the Buddha. That quote was the Ajahn Chah quote about choosing the kind of suffering that leads to the end of suffering rather than choosing the kind of suffering that leads to more suffering. So this is the call, this is the possibility that we can do. The more we are Buddha-like in some way, no matter how modest, certainly in my own instance, the more impact we will have. And rather than thinking of the results of our actions, we think of the very step right now, this step. So if right now I am answering my heart's call from my deepest values in this way of liberation, of causing non-harming, to be liberating my mind from greed, hatred, and delusion in a way that would lead to harming myself or another, then I am serving the Dharma, I am serving the community, and I am inspiring others. And we're inspiring each other. And we're inspiring each person, one person at a time. It's radical, that idea that we human beings would stop being so destructive to ourselves and others and to the environment by one person at a time. It's really radical. My mind does not want to believe that. And yet, again, the longer I live, the more I see that this is really a possibility. And that for each of us to enlist in this, to not be clinging to our concept of making it all happen at once and making it happen our way, this radicalness of saying no, in this very step, this is my faith right here and now, and I will not be attached to outcome. I will learn from what turns out to be effective and not, but I won't be attached to outcome. I will put my faith in the process that the knowing the truth does in fact set us free in that way when it's applied with a perseverance and a patience, as taught in the Paramis, the great attainments, the 10 attainments, the 10 perfections, the Paramis in Theravada Buddhism. And this in turn brings up this question about, well, but what about in my own practice? How do I practice with sincerity and yet not get caught in the results? Because if I'm not really measuring by results, then I get lost. Or how do I know if I'm getting anywhere? Or how do I know if I'm doing the right practice? And but if I'm not making a difference, I don't want to spend my time with this. I want to be doing something different. And so how do we go about being committed to practice and not cling to outcome? Not easy. Not easy at all. Sometimes we have to remember the continuity of our effort. I can't remember if I read this poem in here or not, so actually I'll start with another one, just in case I did that one. Be taught now, among the trees and rocks, how the discarded is woven into shelter. Learn the way things hidden and unspoken slowly proclaim their voice in the world. Find that far inward symmetry to all outward appearances. Apprentice yourself to yourself. Begin to welcome back all you sent away. Be a new annunciation. Make yourself a door through which to be hospitable to even to the stranger in you. It's an excerpt from a David White poem. In this way, we, in our own practice, when we see those moments of not showing up for practice, those points when in our daily life we're not practicing mindfulness, or where we're certainly not living the Dharma values we supposedly embrace, and yet here we are practicing wrong speech, or being caught completely in greed, or so deluded we don't know what's going on. When we see those moments, when we wake up to them, no matter how late in the process of waking up to them, we stop there. This too is to be known. This too is worthy of mindfulness. Not just mindfulness in an abstract knowing, but this compassionate mindfulness where we meet this too with our heart's knowing. We include this aspect, this behavior, this old habit, this conditions-based reactive mind state. We welcome it, we know it, we include it. Because if we fail to do so, we can't start. We can't start in our practice. If we abandon that moment, that aspect of ourself, that conditioned reactivity, and we go over here to our good little Buddhist practicing self, we're actually not practicing with what's true in the moment. And the teaching is that we start where we are. So if greed is present, then the greedy person starts practicing. The greedy person sees the suffering. Not this good Buddhist that sees the suffering, but no, this person that's greedy right now, that wants what it wants right now, can we be with that person? That's much more interesting than going over to where the shoulds lie.
Say that again.
We start where we are. So if it's the greedy person that's present right now, we practice, we stay present for the greedy person. The greedy person. We're not saying, oh, I shouldn't be the greedy person. No, we're compassionate in our mindfulness with that greedy person. And we see for ourselves what the suffering caused by that greedy aspect of ourselves. We see what are the causes and conditions that are causing it to arise and flourish. We see not from a should, but from this wisdom, this compassionate wisdom, that, well, what alternatives do we have in this moment? Because we're greedy right now. We're not abandoning the greediness. We're allowing the greediness to be transformed by our attention, our wise, compassionate attention. It's a much harder practice, but it's much more interesting. It's much more interesting. In the one hand, we do genuinely seek transformation. We want to be both less than we are in some ways and more than what we are. This is the wise understanding of the Eightfold Path, that first aspect of the Eightfold Path. And that's why this question comes up about what are we really doing when we do spiritual practice, when we commit to inner development. What are we really doing? Now, is this just a feel-good thing? Is this just a feel-good? Sometimes it is that for people. It's a way of feeling good. There's a way of, particularly right now, it's very in, you know, to have mindfulness, and it's in to sort of make references to Buddhism in all sorts of ways. People will say, oh, I'm really in to Buddhism. I'm really interested in it. Well, what is your practice? Oh, I don't have a practice yet, but I read a lot about it. And that's a start, to start with an intellectual understanding. But then at some point, the practice becomes the call, of walking around mindfulness practice, a lived wisdom practice in daily life, and some sort of formal sitting practice that gets us enough muscle building in the mind heart, build up that muscle so that we can, in fact, live out what we're embracing. Living out means choosing to be kind when there's not a lot of feeling of kindness in them. And we've got enough muscle to choose kindness. We've got enough clarity of mind. We have practiced kindness. We've practiced being present enough that empowers choice. But it also is the muscle of renunciation. Because without the ability to say no to that greediness, we can't overcome the impulse, the reactive mind that is greedy, that's aversive in this way. So what we're really doing in our practice is bringing more awareness so that we're replacing slowly ignorance with wisdom. Slowly, slowly replacing ignorance with wisdom. Seeing for ourselves, as we saw in the meditation, that there is knowing, that knowing can be in the situation so that we're not just the immediacy of those thoughts, the immediacy of those body sensations, but there's greater, and that we're learning to have choice. We're equipping ourselves to have choice and to understand why we would value choice, having choice, and why we would value the choice of choosing non-suffering. Because it's not so clear in the living of our daily lives why we would choose that. We love the soap opera. Why would I choose something that's not feeding the soap opera? This is my life, the soap opera. It can so feel that way. So this idea of against the stream, as the Buddha taught, it's quite radical, this going in this other way. Sticking with this theme of letting go of results a little longer, don't we all really want results? Don't we really want results? Maybe it is not the results themselves that are the problem, but our understanding, our perception of what we mean when we say results. We are oriented to winning, to getting what we want. That is the measure of success in the culture in which we live. But maybe, just maybe, the results that we should be measuring is the results of being present. Was I present or not present? Did I choose as best I was able? Did I even know? Did I remember to choose? Did I remember? Did I remember to look around? Do I have any choice in this situation when this person has been rude to me, or that I realize that they're trying to cheat me in this situation? They're really trying to charge me a different price than what we just agreed on? In that moment where I am frightened because I'm going to be taken advantage of, can I remember? Maybe I couldn't act, but I remembered. I was at least present for the fact that I was frightened. So that looking for the immediacy of awareness, the immediacy of knowing what I'm about, the immediacy of do I have choice, these might be the results we're looking for, rather than, oh, I feel like a new person. And maybe in this more modest, this more immediacy of attention, the more emphasis on here and now, there will come a far greater fruition than in trying to jump ahead to delivering. I'm going to deliver the goods. I'm going to really show up and to the degree that I could brag to my friends about it. It's a real genuine question in that way. We have been, and we will continue to get lost so often until we don't. And for most of us, and certainly in the teaching of the gradual path, It's we don't get lost in this one anymore. We don't get lost in that one anymore. And before that, there is we get less lost less often for a less period of time and with less intensity of being lost. That's the orientation. If you want your mindfulness to make a difference in your life, in my experience with lots of people, that's how it makes a difference. The here and now having both a very mysterious reference. Very mysterious. What is here? What is now in this vast awareness? And this immediacy of experience. So immediate. Much more immediate than you may think. Much more immediate. Right now. Right now. This is a poem called Soy Latte. I should have ordered the soy latte. But instead, I'm sitting here with my large whole milk double espresso mocha. Mocha, is that how you pronounce it? Mocha? Mocha. See, I'm not a coffee drinker. Large whole milk double espresso mocha with extra whipped cream. Savoring the sweet taste of defiance. And basking in the warmth of the carcinogenic sun. A few feet away, a small boy is storming the walls of a castle, cleverly disguised as a bench. He runs at it again and again with squeals of delight, punctuated by the occasional protests of his mother telling him to behave. He ignores her. I drink my mocha. The boy continues running and squealing. He is winning the battle. The voice of authority is no match for his exuberance. Not today. But on another day, years ago, when another boy was storming a similar castle, the battering rams of admonition finally breached the walls of his young mind. Despite the loss, he fights on to this day. And though the struggle still rages, it is now contained inside the walls. And at some point, running became exercise. And the simple act of deciding what to drink became a proxy battle in the Cold War between submission and rebellion. This by a local Sangha member, Rob Cook. So here we are out in life, and we get lost in our story. And we're caught in our sadness or some narrative, something that often is about the other and what the others are doing to us or don't see us, or how we don't fit in to the others, or some other version that you may have of this endless, endless creation of narrative, feeding the narrative, protecting the narrative at all cost. You know what I mean. Last Sunday, I was participating in the marriage ceremony of Arden. Must have been two Sundays ago that I was in Los Angeles and offered a day long on letting go of your story, how to free yourself from the narrative. I don't know if that day long was recorded or not. Was it Against the Stream? You could go on the website and look. It's a real challenge, this not getting caught in our story, our sadness, the memories of our past. It does require a continuous rebellion. It is a lifelong practice against the Cold War. We get caught time and again. And lots of times we feel as though it is the story that it is the event of this moment that's getting us. But it's really the story. How many times have we had a defeat, and that defeat has seemed so big, and yet life has gone on? Proof that life has gone on is that we're all sitting in this room. So, ipso facto, we're here, so life has gone on. Maybe not as the story we would have had unfold, but it has gone on in some way. So what do we choose? Do we choose the narrative in our head that we feed over and over again? Or do we choose the life that's unfolding here, now? Do we choose the immediacy of our experience and attend to it through this compassionate mindfulness? Compassionate towards ourselves, loving kindness towards ourselves, kindness and a compassion towards others as best we're able. Do we attend to ourselves in this moment, in the context of this moment, or do we feed this overarching story? It's not that the overarching story is not necessary. We human beings survive. We interpret. We know what to do based on story. We cannot live without story. We wouldn't know what to do. We would not know what to do in the next moment. We wouldn't know how to listen to this Dhamma talk without the context of story. But when it gets to the personal story, it may be that we are taking too much comfort in it. We are relying on it. We are giving too much that's precious here and now to that story. And so we choose otherwise. Yes, this is hurtful. Yes, this is sadness. This is the same sadness of rejection or not fitting in or not getting what I want that I've felt over and over again. But I'm just going to deal with this one just now. I'm going to attend to myself in this moment as though this is the one thing I can do, is attend to myself in this moment and attend to others in this moment as best I am able. Because we can somewhat attend to ourselves. Sometimes we can't attend to another. And so we do. We show up in this moment for ourselves, letting loose of the story. It'll stay in the background. It's not going away, that big story. You know it's not. It's very reliable. It can only live through you, so it wants to stick around you. Therefore, you can take some space from it. More faithful than any puppy dog. It will stay around. And so in this moment, we look for any degree of well-being. We look for any degree of choice. We look for the precepts. We look for this being able to bear the suffering in this moment, to let go of the clinging in this moment. Very practical in terms of well-being. And so dharmic here. When we are living the Dharma in daily life as best we can, having to see what's left in my inventory. It's hard to choose the poems before you know the topic. when we're living the Dharma in daily life as best we're able, we get into many situations where we are in community with a single person, a small group of people like friends or people at work, or a larger community. And sometimes that community is physically present. It's local in the sense of the immediate geographical sense of we're all in this room together. You're at lunch with your friends. You took a hike today with your friends. You rode in the car with someone coming here. And then sometimes it's more digital, where we're in a community through email or messaging or all of those services that I don't know the names of. And that's a community too. And then sometimes we're in the ether of the television or the news on the internet or whatever it is, where we're with all citizens of the U.S. or people who think the way we do, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's, I just wanted to mention something that I knew. I was plugging Facebook. And in all these instances, we have to struggle with how, when we're with the other, how to be aware of self, of what we are about. What self meaning? What self meaning? What is it that this being cares about? There is embodied awareness here. Not a mean or mine, not that kind of embodied awareness, but an embodied awareness that can choose, that is receiving this moment in this larger sense of we enter are, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, that this moment is co-arising. Everyone in this room is creating this moment. How many of you at that moment said that's not true? Or how many of you just kind of let that fly by? I'm going to easily prove it to you. In this moment, you are playing a vital part. So, for instance, let's suppose you stood up and started screaming. Changed the room a lot. You stood up and started taking all your clothes off, which has happened on a number of retreats where people have lost it and taken all their clothes off or stood up in the dining hall and started screaming. These are the kinds of things have happened on retreat. So sometimes our contribution is in showing up and participating in a way that allows the unfolding as it's been imagined to go forth. So nobody is standing up and screaming. We don't want any examples of, we don't need any actual proof. We can do this is a conceptual proof, an example proof. And so that's one way. Another way is your attention is contributing to the attention of the whole room. This was so true in the sit. The sit had there was such a stillness in the room and such a sense of spaciousness. And I could feel it in all corners. And it's not that everybody in the room was having that kind of an experience inside, because I can actually feel the little stirrings in the room with little storms in various places when I'm still enough myself. So it's not that. But it is in our attitude. It is in the way we're lining up to meet this moment that we're contributing. That is one way that when we're with others, we're with ourselves. We're being with ourselves by living our values. Sometimes that's having an immediate mindfulness of choosing our values. But other times, it's because we have conditioned, we have replaced old habits with new habits, so that there is an intentionalness to being with another that is very lodged in our self-cultivation. But it's so lodged, we don't actually have to think about it. It's become a natural response in this moment. And this is the intentional life of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha references it in terms of non-harming, in terms of kindness, in terms of renunciation. And it becomes a habit. It becomes a natural reference. At some point in my own practice, I realized that not only was this starting to happen, I needed to do everything I could to foster this happening, because there was too much stimulation when I was with others to be able to go, now what is it I'm doing here? That it needed to be built in, that much of it needed to be built in, that this was an attitude that I brought to every moment. No matter what I was doing, no matter what goal I was going towards, whether it was getting a weight person to understand that I'm allergic to onions and olives, and no, you can't do this in food, and to the annoyance of the people with me, I'm having to repeat this three times, because there's the dukkha of eating something one's allergic to at a certain degree of intensity. It's worth the discomfort of repeating something three times and being slightly annoying, no matter how nice one is. That sense of being about something in that way, that little way, or some big way, when something is happening that you go, no, I can't support this. And it often happens in life that really, if we're present, if we're being true to ourselves when we're with others, we have to get up and leave because we can't support this conversation, or we have to intervene. We have to say, no, this doesn't feel right to me. And if it doesn't feel right to do that, it's harmful, or it's not worth it, we excuse ourselves. We just don't participate. We stand for what we are about in one form or another. In one form or another. And so it is with omission and commission in terms of causing harm. For myself, I am, in general, my own self-assessment, which could, of course, be diluted, the commission of causing harm, you know, I'm really alert to. Maybe it doesn't happen too much. And when it does happen, I really try to take responsibility as immediately as I can for it, as best I can. But omission harm is far trickier. When we don't do something, when we don't speak, when we don't offer, when we're not generous, when we let something be said that was unkind. And I find that in living the Dharma in daily life, which is what we're about here, I find that challenging at times. At times, because I look back and I go, so was that a harm of omission or not? You know, what is that? And maybe each of you could think that. So rather than having a broad sense of how to be aware of our own self, that while we're with others, we take little aspects and we work on one little aspect after another. And we explore for ourselves. So let's say that there's a situation where something doesn't feel right in your work community. Maybe it's a social service community. Maybe it's even a Dharma community. So how do you be present? How do you be present here? And in the middle of it, you sort of check in with yourself. Am I here? Do I have choice? Am I being true to what I care about in both my acts and my non-acting? We just check in occasionally. We're not trying to nail it. It's not that nail it, getting it right attitude. It's much more humble than that. Just wanting to know, we trust this mindfulness, the mindfulness of the Buddha, that if we know the Dharma will do us, if we can just show up, the Dharma will do us, that we know. But we're showing up in the context of the Dharma, not in a secular context, because secular context always leads us back to winning. Winning for me and mine. But no, winning isn't everything. Because that's such a narrow definition of winning. And it's a zero-sum game in that way. And inevitably leads to harm. It's not that we're against winning. It's that we are not slaves to winning. It is not our golden calf in that way. And then finally, this leads me, in terms of being with self and other, to this very, very difficult situation, one that I'm practicing with at the moment, which is how to make a decision when there is no good decision. There's not a right decision. There's only suffering. And the example is in dealing with a member of my family right now where I'm having to make the decision for this person and their life because for various reasons they can't make it for themselves. This is a member of my family of origin. And I've had a long history of being responsible in various ways in this person's life. And it's a health situation where there's not a good decision. There's just not a good decision. There's not something oh, I'm going to be generous and make this decision, or oh, I'm going to do tough love and make this decision. There's not a good decision. There's unpleasantness and it's difficult. It's going to be difficult for this person, whatever this happens. So my first response when this came up was one of, I don't want to be doing this. Why am I having to make this decision? I'm only going to be regarded negatively. I'm only going to feel towards myself like, you know, you didn't do enough. Why am I having to do this? I've done all these other things for this person all these years. And I mean a lot of years, by the way. So I could really justify it. I could really get behind that as an emotion. This was reactive mind. This was reactive mind. And it went on because it was a very difficult decision. And I really felt bad. It's who wants to make a decision when there's not a good outcome? When there's you can't even say, oh, well, maybe this will work out for the best. It's just, there was not a best. It was just a difficult decision. And then there was in addition to the resentment, there was a real resistance to this. So I would delay. I would try to find an excuse to not make it. And in fact, this is supported by the fact that one thing that led me to make a number of good decisions in life, and it's surprising that people don't know this, is one shouldn't make a decision until one has to make a decision. Why do you make a decision before you have to make a decision? Things may change. You want to be very careful about knowing the timing if you're going to live that way. But when I was living in the world, it would drive the people that worked with me crazy because I'd come in and say, oh, we've got to make a decision about this. What do you want to do? And I'd say, I don't have to decide yet. No, I need to know. And I'd say, no, you don't. Drive them crazy. But I almost always was right. Because I really cared about that. I really gave time to this assessment. I was present in that way. And so in this situation, I kept trying to understand the right timing, but the timing would move out from under me. And so finally, I had this moment a few days ago where all the resentment and all of the resistance blossomed, morphed, transformed itself only into tenderness. Only tenderness. Why did that happen? If I were going to say, I would say it's because of practice. It was not anything in my head. I didn't think, oh, you know, what's needed here? What a good Buddhist would do is have compassionate mindfulness. Oh, metta for me and for this person. I didn't have thoughts like that. In that way, I had the person in my metta practice, but I had no thoughts like that. I was in when I dealt with the situation, there was resentment and resistance till there wasn't. It transformed itself into tenderness. This is how we practice with our awareness with others. We are available for the Dharma to transform us. We allow the Dharma to do us. We let our hearts be available gradually, slowly, not getting ahead of ourselves because we'll make ourselves too vulnerable. We won't know. We have our armor for a reason. We have these old habits for a reason. So we slowly let go and let go. We're not trying to let go all at once, but slowly, here, now, let go to what degree that feels appropriate. And then there starts to be these moments, call them grace, call them moments of awakening, call them moments of letting go, where there is some grasping, some holding, some selfing, and it transforms itself into tenderness, into caring. We're the fortunate beneficiaries of that. But our reliance, our practice, what we're about in practice is practice. We are resting in the practice. What are we doing in our spiritual practice? How to be with self and others? We just practice. Each moment of our lives, as we deepen in our understanding, each moment of our lives is simply another moment of practice. That becomes our refuge for the moment, that this is a moment of practice. And when seen from the perspective of practice, it slowly is being transformed, alchemically, unseen, mysteriously, here, now. Let's sit for a moment.